Bad news, said Tom Builder. Philip simmered with fury all through Vespers. What Earl Percy had done was outrageous. There was no doubt about the rights and wrongs of the case, no ambiguity about the king's instructions. The Earl had been there himself when the announcement was made, and the priory's right to mine the quarry was enshrined in a charter. Philip's right foot tapped the stone floor of the crypt in an urgent, angry rhythm. He was being robbed. Percy might as well steal pennies from a church treasury. There was no shred of an excuse for it. Percy was flagrantly defying both God and the king. But the worst of it was that Philip could not build the new cathedral unless he got the stone for nothing from that quarry. He was already working with a bare minimum budget, and if he had to pay the market price for his stone and transport it from even farther away, he could not build at all. He would have to wait another year or more, and then it would be 6 or 7 years before he could hold services in a cathedral again. The thought was too much to bear. He held an emergency chapter immediately after Vespers and told the monks the news. He had developed a technique for handling chapter meetings. Remigius, the sub-prior, still bore a grudge against Philip for defeating him in the election, and he often let his resentment show when monastery business was discussed. He was a conservative, unimaginative, pedantic man, and his whole approach to the running of the priory conflicted with Philip's. The brothers who had supported Remigius in the election tended to back him in chapter. Andrew, the apoplectic sacrist, Pierre, the circuiter, who was responsible for discipline and had the narrow-minded attitudes that seemed to go with the job, and John Small, the lazy treasurer. Similarly, Philip's closest colleagues were the men who had campaigned for him, Cuthbert Whitehead, the old cellarer, and young Milius, to whom Philip had given the newly created post of bursar, controller of the priory's finances. Philip always let Milius argue with Remigius. Philip had normally discussed anything important with Milius before the meeting, and when he had not, Milius could be relied on to present a point of view close to Philip's own. Then Philip could sum up like an impartial arbiter, and although Remigius rarely got his way, Philip would often accept some of his arguments or adopt part of his proposal to maintain the feeling of consensus government. The monks were enraged by what Earl Percy had done. They had all rejoiced when King Stephen had given the priory unlimited free timber and stone, and now they were scandalized that Percy should defy the king's order. When the protests died down, however, Remigius had another point to make.
"I remember saying this a year ago," he began. "The pact, according to which the quarry is owned by the Earl but we have quarrying rights, was always unsatisfactory. We should have held out for total ownership."
The fact that there was some justice in this remark did not make it any easier for Philip to swallow. Total ownership was what he had agreed with Lady Regan, but she had cheated him out of it at the last minute. He was tempted to say that he had got the best deal he could, and he would like to see Remigius do any better in the treacherous maze of the royal court, but he bit his tongue, for he was, after all, the prior, and he had to take responsibility when things went wrong. Milius came to his rescue.
"It's all very well to wish the king had given us outright ownership of the quarry, but he didn't, and the main question is, what do we do now?"
"I should think that's fairly obvious," Remigius said immediately. "We can't expel the Earl's men ourselves, so we'll have to get the king to do it. We must send a deputation to him and ask him to enforce his charter."
There was a murmur of agreement. Andrew the sacrist said,
"We should send our wisest and most fluent speakers."
Philip realized that Remigius and Andrew saw themselves as leading the delegation. Remigius said,
"After the king hears what has happened, I don't think Percy Hamley will be Earl of Shiring much longer."
Philip was not so sure of that.
"Where is the king?" Andrew said as an afterthought. "Does anybody know?"
Philip had recently been to Winchester and had heard there of the king's movements.
"He's gone to Normandy," he said.
Milius quickly said, "It will take a long time to catch up with him."
"The pursuit of justice always requires patience," Remigius intoned pompously. "But every day we spend pursuing justice, we're not building our new cathedral," Milius replied.
His tone of voice showed that he was exasperated by Remigius's ready acceptance of a delay to the building program. Philip shared that feeling. Milius went on, "And that's not our only problem. Once we've found the king, we have to persuade him to hear us. That can take weeks. Then he may give Percy the chance to defend himself. More delay." "How could Percy possibly defend himself?" Remigius said testily. Milius replied, "I don't know, but I'm sure he'll think of something." "But in the end, the king is bound to stand by his word." A new voice was heard saying, "Don't be so sure." Everyone turned to look. The speaker was Brother Timothy, the oldest monk in the priory. A small, modest man, he spoke rarely, but when he did, he was worth listening to. Philip occasionally thought Timothy should have been prior. He normally sat through chapter looking half asleep, but now he was leaning forward, his eyes bright with conviction. "A king is a creature of the moment," he went on. "He's constantly under threat from rebels within his own kingdom and from neighbouring monarchs. He needs allies. Earl Percy is a powerful man with a lot of knights. If the king needs Percy at the moment when we present our petition, we will be refused, quite regardless of the justice of our case. The king is not perfect. There is only one true judge, and that is God." He sat back, leaning against the wall and half-closing his eyes, as if he were not in the least interested in how his speech was received. Philip concealed a smile. Timothy had precisely formulated Philip's own misgivings about going to the king for justice. Remigius was reluctant to give up the prospect of a long, exciting trip to France and a sojourn at the royal court, but at the same time he could not contradict Timothy's logic. "What else can we do, then?" he said. Philip was not sure. The sheriff would not be able to intervene in this case. Percy was too powerful to be controlled by a mere sheriff. And the bishop could not be relied upon either. It was frustrating, but Philip was not willing to sit back and accept defeat. He would take over that quarry if he had to do it himself. Now there was an idea. "Just a minute," he said. It would involve all the able-bodied brothers in the monastery. It would have to be carefully organized, like a military operation without weapons. They would need food for 2 days. "I don't know if this will work, but it's worth a try," he said. "Listen." He told them his plan. They set out almost immediately. 30 monks, 10 novices, Otto Blackface and his team of quarrymen, Tom Builder and Alfred, 2 horses and a cart. When darkness fell, they lit lanterns to show them the road. At midnight, they stopped to rest and eat the picnic the kitchen had hastily prepared. Chicken, white bread, and red wine. Philip had always believed that hard work should be rewarded by good food. When they marched on, they sang the service they should have been performing back at the priory. At some point, during the darkest hour, Tom Builder, who was leading the way, held up a hand to stop them. He said to Philip, "Only a mile or more to the quarry." "Good," said Philip. He turned to the monks. "Take off your clogs and sandals and put on the felt boots." He took off his own sandals and pulled on a pair of the soft felt boots that peasants wore in winter. He singled out 2 novices, Edward and Philemon. "Stay here with the horses and the cart. Keep quiet and wait until full daylight. Then join us. Is that clear?"
"Yes, father," they said together.
"All right, the rest of you," Philip said. "Follow Tom Builder now, in complete silence, please." They all walked on. There was a light west wind blowing, and the rustling of the trees covered the sound of 50 men breathing and 50 pairs of felt boots shuffling. Philip began to feel tense. His plan seemed a little crazy now that he was about to put it into operation. He said a silent prayer for success. The road curved to the left, and then the flickering lanterns dimly showed a wooden lodge, a stack of part-finished stone blocks, some ladders and scaffolding, and in the background a dark hillside disfigured by the white scars of quarrying. Philip suddenly wondered whether the men asleep in the lodge had dogs. If they did, Philip would lose the element of surprise and the whole scheme would be jeopardized. But it was too late to back out now. The whole crowd shuffled past the lodge. Philip held his breath, expecting at any moment to hear a cacophony of barking, but there were no dogs. He brought his people to a halt around the base of the scaffolding. He was proud of them for being so quiet. It was difficult for people to stay silent, even in church. Perhaps they were too frightened to make a noise. Tom Builder and Otto Blackface began silently to place the quarrymen around the site. They divided them into two groups. One group gathered near the rock face at ground level. The others mounted the scaffolding. When they were all in position, Philip directed the monks with gestures to stand or sit around the workmen. He himself stayed apart from the rest, at a point halfway between the lodge and the rock face. Their timing was perfect. Dawn came a few moments after Philip made his final dispositions. He took a candle from inside his cloak and lit it from a lantern. Then he faced the monks and lifted the candle. It was a prearranged signal. Each of the 40 monks and novices took out a candle and lit it from one of the three lanterns. The effect was dramatic. Day broke over a quarry occupied by silent, ghostly figures, each holding a small, flickering light. Philip turned again to face the lodge. As yet, there was no sign of life. He settled down to wait. Monks were good at that. Standing still for hours was part of their everyday life. The workmen were not so used to it, however, and they began to get impatient after a while, shuffling their feet and murmuring to one another in low voices. But it did not matter now. Either the muttering or the strengthening daylight woke the inhabitants of the lodge. Philip heard someone cough and spit. Then there was a scraping noise, as of a bar being lifted from behind a door. He held up his hand for dead silence. The door of the lodge swung open. Philip kept his hand in the air. A man came out rubbing his eyes. Philip knew him from Tom's description to be Harold of Shiring, the master quarryman. Harold did not see anything unusual at first. He leaned against the doorpost and coughed again, the deep, bubbling cough of a man who has too much stone dust in his lungs. Philip dropped his hand. Somewhere behind him the cantor hit a note, and immediately all the monks began to sing. The quarry was flooded with eerie harmonies. The effect on Harold was devastating. His head jerked up as if it had been pulled by a string. His eyes widened and his jaw dropped as he saw the spectral choir that had appeared as if by magic in his quarry. A cry of fear escaped from his open mouth. He staggered back through the door of the lodge. Philip permitted himself a satisfied smile. It was a good start. However, the supernatural dread would not last very long. He lifted his hand again and waved it without turning around. In response to his signal, the quarrymen started to work, and the clang of iron on rock punctuated the music of the choir. Two or three faces peeped fearfully from the doorway. The men soon realized they were looking at ordinary corporeal monks and workmen, not visions or spirits, and they stepped out of the lodge for a better view. Two men-at-arms came out, buckling their sword-belts, and stood staring. This was the crucial moment for Philip. What would the men-at-arms do? The sight of them, big and bearded and dirty, with their chain-link belts, their swords and daggers, and their heavy leather jerkins, brought back to Philip a vivid, crystal-clear memory of the two soldiers who had burst into his home when he was 6 years old and killed his mother and father. He was stabbed, suddenly and unexpectedly, by grief for the parents he hardly remembered. He stared with loathing at Earl Percy's men, not seeing them, but seeing instead an ugly man with a bent nose and a dark man with blood in his beard, and he was filled with rage and disgust and a fierce determination that such mindless, godless ruffians should be defeated. For a while they did nothing. Gradually all the Earl's quarrymen came out of the lodge. Philip counted them. There were 12 workmen plus the men-at-arms. The sun peeped over the horizon. The Kingsbridge quarrymen were already digging out stones. If the men-at-arms wanted to stop them, they would have to lay hands on the monks, who surrounded and protected the workers. Philip had gambled that the men-at-arms would hesitate to do violence to praying monks. So far he was right. They were hesitating. The two novices, who had been left behind, now arrived, leading the horses and the cart. They looked around fearfully. Philip indicated with a gesture where they should pull up. Then he turned, met Tom Builder's eye, and nodded. Several stones had been cut by this time, and now Tom directed some of the younger monks to pick up the stones and carry them to the cart. The Earl's men watched this new development with interest. The stones were too heavy to be lifted by one man, so they had to be lowered from the scaffolding by ropes, then carried across the ground on stretchers. As the first stone was manhandled into the cart, the men-at-arms went into a huddle with Harold. Another stone was put into the cart. The two men-at-arms separated from the crowd around the lodge and walked over to the cart. One of the novices, Philemon, climbed into the cart and sat on the stones, looking defiant. "Brave lad," thought Philip, but he was afraid. The men approached the cart. The four monks who had carried the two stones stood in front of it, forming a barrier. Philip tensed. The men stopped and stood face to face with the monks. They both put their hands to the hilts of their swords. The singing stopped as everyone watched with bated breath. "Surely," Philip thought, "they won't be able to bring themselves to put defenseless monks to the sword." Then he thought how easy it would be for them, big, strong men who were accustomed to the slaughter of the battlefield, to run their sharp swords through these people, from whom they had nothing to fear, not even retaliation. Then again they must consider the divine punishment they would risk by murdering men of God. Even thugs such as these must know that eventually they would stand at the day of judgment. Were they afraid of the eternal fire? Perhaps. But they were also afraid of their employer, Earl Percy. Philip guessed that the thought uppermost in their minds must be whether he would consider they had an adequate excuse for their failure to keep the Kingsbridge men out of the quarry. He watched them, hesitating in front of a handful of young monks, hands on their swords, and imagined them weighing the danger of failing Percy against the wrath of God. The two men looked at one another. One shook his head. The other shrugged. Together they walked out of the quarry. The cantor hit a new note and the monks burst into a triumphant hymn. A shout of victory went up from the quarrymen. Philip sagged with relief. For a moment it had looked dreadfully dangerous. He could not help beaming with pleasure. The quarry was his. He blew out his candle and went over to the cart. He embraced each of the four monks who had faced the men-at-arms, and the two novices who had brought the cart. "I'm proud of you," he said warmly, "and I believe God is too." The monks and the quarrymen were all shaking hands and congratulating one another. Otto Blackface came over to Philip and said, "That was well done, Father Philip. You're a brave man, if I may say so." "God protected us," Philip said. His eye fell on the Earl's quarrymen, standing in a disconsolate group around the door of their lodge. He did not want to make enemies of them, for while they were at a loose end, there would always be a danger that Percy would use them to make further trouble. Philip decided to speak to them. He took Otto's arm and led him over to the lodge. "God's will has been done here today," he said to Harold. "I hope there are no hard feelings." "We're out of work," Harold said. "That's a hard feeling." Philip suddenly saw a way to get Harold's men on his side. Impulsively, he said, "You can be back in work today if you want. Work for me. I'll hire your whole team. You won't even have to move out of your lodge." Harold was surprised at this turn of events. He looked startled, then recovered his composure and said, "At what wages?" "Standard rates," Philip replied promptly. "Tuppence a day for craftsmen, a penny a day for labourers. Fourpence for yourself, and you pay your own apprentices." Harold turned away and looked at his colleagues. Philip drew Otto away to let them discuss the proposal in private. Philip could not really afford 12 more men, and if they accepted his offer, he would have to postpone further the day when he could hire masons. That meant he would be cutting stone faster than he could use it. He would build up a stockpile, but it would be bad for his flow of cash. However, having all Percy's quarrymen on the priory payroll would be a good defensive move. If Percy wanted to try again to work the quarry himself, he would first have to hire a team of quarrymen. which might be difficult once the news of today's events got around. And if at some future date Percy should try another stratagem to close the quarry, Philip would have a stockpile of stone. Harold appeared to be arguing with his men. After a few moments he left them and approached Philip again. "Who's to be in charge if we work for you?" he said. "Me or your own, Master Quarryman?" "Otto here is in charge," Philip said without hesitation. Harold certainly could not be in charge, in case his loyalty should be won back by Percy, and there could not be two masters, for that would lead to disputes. "You can still run your own team," Philip said to Harold, "but Otto will be over you." Harold looked disappointed and returned to his men. The discussion continued. Tom Builder joined Philip and Otto. "Your plan worked, Father," he said with a broad grin. "We repossessed the quarry without shedding a drop of blood. You're amazing." Philip was inclined to agree, and realized he was guilty of the sin of pride. "It was God who worked the miracle," he said, reminding himself as well as Tom. Otto said, "Father Philip has offered to hire Harold and his men to work with me." "Really?" Tom looked displeased. It was the master builder who was supposed to recruit craftsmen, not the prior. "I shouldn't have thought he could afford it." "I can't," Philip admitted, "but I don't want these men hanging around with nothing to do, waiting for Percy to think of another way to get the quarry back." Tom looked thoughtful, then he nodded. "And it will do no harm to have a reserve of stone in case Percy succeeds." Philip was glad Tom saw the sense of what he had done. Harold seemed to be reaching agreement with his men. He came back to Philip and said, "Will you pay the wages to me and leave me to distribute the money as I think fit?" Philip was dubious. That meant the master could take more than his share. But he said, "It's up to the master builder." "It's common enough," Tom said. "If that's what your team wants, I'm willing." "In that case, we accept," Harold said. Harold and Tom shook hands. Philip said, "So everyone gets what they want. Good." "There's one who hasn't got what they want," Harold said.
"Who's that?"
said Philip.
"Earl Percy's wife, Regan," Harold said lugubriously. "When she finds out what's happened here, there's going to be blood all over the floor."
2. There was no hunting today, so the young men at Earl's Castle played one of William Hamley's favourite games, stoning the cat. There were always plenty of cats in the castle, and one more or less made no difference. The men closed the doors and shuttered the windows of the hall of the keep, and pushed the furniture up against the wall, so that the cat could not hide behind anything. Then they made a pile of stones in the middle of the room. The cat, an aging mouser with grey in its fur, sensed the bloodlust in the air, and sat near the door, hoping to get out. Each man had to put a penny into the pot for each stone he threw, and the man who threw the fatal stone took the pot. As they drew lots to determine the order of throwing, the cat became agitated, pacing up and down in front of the door. Walter threw first. This was lucky, for although the cat was wary, it did not know the nature of the game, and might be taken by surprise. With his back to the animal, Walter picked a stone from the pile and concealed it in his hand. Then he turned around slowly and threw suddenly. He missed. The stone thudded into the door, and the cat jumped and ran. The others jeered. It was unlucky to throw second, for the cat was fresh and light on its feet, whereas later it would be tired and possibly injured. A young squire was next. He watched the cat run around the room looking for a way out, and waited until it slowed down, then he threw. It was a good shot, but the cat saw it coming and dodged it. The men groaned. It ran around the room again, faster now, getting panicky, jumping up onto the trestles and boards that were stacked against the wall, jumping back down to the floor. An older knight threw next. He feinted a throw to see which way the cat would jump, then threw for real when it was running, aiming a little ahead of it. The others applauded his cunning, but the cat saw the stone coming and stopped suddenly, avoiding it. In desperation, the cat tried to squeeze behind an oak chest in a corner. The next thrower saw an opportunity and seized it. He threw quickly while the cat was stationary and struck its rump. A great cheer went up. The cat gave up trying to squeeze behind the chest and ran on around the room, but now it was limping and it moved more slowly. It was William's turn next. He thought he could probably kill the cat if he was careful. In order to tire it a little more, he yelled at it, making it run faster for a moment. Then he feinted a throw with the same effect. If one of the others had delayed like this, he would have been booed. But William was the Earl's son, so they waited patiently. The cat slowed down, obviously in pain. It approached the door hopefully. William drew back his arm. Unexpectedly, the cat stopped against the wall beside the door. William began to throw. Before the stone left his hand, the door was flung open, and a priest in black stood there. William threw, but the cat sprang like an arrow from a bow, howling triumphantly. The priest in the doorway gave a frightened, high-pitched shriek and clutched at the skirts of his robes. The young men burst out laughing. The cat cannoned into the priest's legs, then landed on its feet and shot out through the door. The priest stood frozen in an attitude of fright, like an old woman scared by a mouse, and the young men roared with laughter. William recognized the priest. It was Bishop Walleran. He laughed all the more. The fact that the womanish priest who had been frightened by a cat was also a rival of the family made it even better. The bishop recovered his composure very quickly. He flushed red, pointed an accusing finger at William and said in a grating voice, "You'll suffer eternal torment in the lowest depths of hell." William's laughter turned to terror in a flash. His mother had given him nightmares when he was small, by telling him what the devils did to people in hell, burning them in the flames and poking their eyes out and cutting off their private parts with sharp knives, and ever since then he hated to hear talk of it. "Shut up!" he screamed at the bishop. The room fell silent. William drew his knife and walked toward Walleran. "Don't you come here preaching, you snake!" Walleran did not look frightened at all, just intrigued, as if he was interested to have discovered William's weakness, and that made William angrier still. "I'll swing for you, so help me." He was mad enough to knife the bishop, but he was stopped by a voice from the staircase behind him. "William! Enough!" It was his father. William stopped and, after a moment, sheathed his knife. Walleran came into the hall. Another priest followed him and shut the door behind him. Dean Baldwin. Father said, "I'm surprised to see you, Bishop."
"Because last time we met you induced the prior of Kingsbridge to double-cross me. Yes, I suppose you would be surprised. I'm not normally a forgiving man."
He turned his icy gaze on William again for a moment, then looked back at Father.
"But I don't bear a grudge when it's against my interest. We need to talk."
Father nodded thoughtfully. "You'd better come upstairs."
"You too, William."
Bishop Walleran and Dean Baldwin climbed the stairs to the Earl's quarters, and William followed. He felt let down because the cat had escaped. On the other hand, he realized that he, too, had had a lucky escape. If he had touched the bishop, he probably would have been hanged for it. But there was something about Walleran's delicacy, his preciousness, that William hated. They went into Father's chamber, the room where William had raped Aliena. He remembered that scene every time he was here, her lush white body, the fear on her face, the way she had screamed, the twisted expression on her little brother's face as he had been forced to look on, and then William's masterstroke, the way he had let Walter enjoy her afterward. He wished he had kept her here, a prisoner, so that he could have her any time he wanted. He had thought about her obsessively ever since. He had even tried to track her down. A verderer had been caught trying to sell William's war horse in Shiring and had confessed, under torture, that he had stolen it from a girl answering to the description of Aliena. William had learned from the Winchester jailer that she had visited her father before he died. And his friend, Mistress Kate, the owner of a brothel he frequented, had told him she had offered Aliena a place in her house, but the trail had petered out.
"Don't let her prey on your mind, Willie boy," Kate had said sympathetically. "You want big tits and long hair? We've got it. Take Betty and Millie together tonight, 4 big breasts all to yourself, why don't you?"
But Betty and Millie had not been innocent and white-skinned and frightened half to death, and they had not pleased him. In fact, he had not achieved real satisfaction with a woman since that night with Aliena here in the Earl's chamber. He put the thought of her out of his mind. Bishop Walleran was speaking to Mother. "I suppose you know that the Prior of Kingsbridge has taken possession of your quarry?" They did not know. William was astonished, and Mother was furious.
"What?" she said. "How?"
"Apparently, your men-at-arms succeeded in turning away the quarrymen, but the next day when they woke up they found the quarry overrun with monks singing hymns, and they were afraid to lay hands on men of God. Prior Philip then hired your quarrymen, and now they're all working together in perfect harmony. I'm surprised the men-at-arms didn't come back to you to report."
"Where are they, the cowards?"
Mother screeched. She was red in the face.
"I'll see to them. I'll make them cut off their own balls."
"I see why they didn't come back,"
Walleran said. "Never mind the men-at-arms," Father said. "They're just soldiers. That sly prior is the one responsible. I never imagined he could pull a trick like this. He's outwitted us, that's all."
"Exactly," said Walleran. "For all his air of saintly innocence, he's got the cunning of a house rat."
William thought that Walleran, too, was like a rat, a black one with a pointed snout and sleek black hair, sitting in a corner with a crust in its paws, darting wary glances around the room as it nibbled its dinner. Why was he interested in who occupied the quarry? He was as cunning as Prior Philip. He, too, was plotting something. Mother said, "We can't let him get away with this. The Hamleys must not be seen to be defeated. That prior must be humiliated." Father was not so sure. "It's only a quarry," he said, "and the king did."
"It's not just the quarry, it's the family honour," Mother interrupted. "Never mind what the king said."
William agreed with Mother. Philip of Kingsbridge had defied the Hamleys, and he had to be crushed. If people were not afraid of you, you had nothing. But he did not see what the problem was.
"Why don't we go in with some men and just throw the prior's quarrymen out?"
Father shook his head. "It's one thing to obstruct the king's wishes passively, as we did by working the quarry ourselves, but quite another to send armed men to expel workmen who are there by express permission of the king. I could lose the earldom for that." William reluctantly saw his point of view. Father was always cautious, but he was usually justified. Bishop Walleran said, "I have a suggestion." William had felt sure he had something up his embroidered black sleeve.
"I believe this cathedral should not be built at Kingsbridge."
William was mystified by this remark. He did not see its relevance, nor did Father. But Mother's eyes widened. She stopped scratching her face for a moment, and she said thoughtfully,
"That's an interesting idea."
"In the old days, most cathedrals were in villages such as Kingsbridge," Walleran went on. "Many of them were moved to towns 60 or 70 years ago, during the time of the first King William. Kingsbridge is a small village in the middle of nowhere. There's nothing there but a run-down monastery that isn't rich enough to maintain a cathedral, let alone build one." Mother said, "And where would you wish it built?"
"Shiring," said Walleran. "It's a big town, the population must be 1,000 or more, and it has a market and an annual fleece fair, and it's on a main road. Shiring makes sense, and if we both campaign for it, the bishop and the earl united, we could push it through."
Father said, "But if the cathedral were at Shiring, the Kingsbridge monks would not be able to look after it."
"That's the point," Mother said impatiently. "Without the cathedral, Kingsbridge would be nothing. The priory would sink back into obscurity, and Philip would once again be a non-entity, which is what he deserves."
"So who would look after the new cathedral?" Father persisted.
"A new chapter of canons," Walleran said, "appointed by me."
William had been as puzzled as his father, but now he began to see Walleran's thinking. In moving the cathedral to Shiring, Walleran would also take personal control of it. "What about the money?" said Father. "Who would pay for the new cathedral, if not Kingsbridge Priory?"
"I think we'd find that most of the priory's property is dedicated to the cathedral," Walleran said. If the cathedral moves, the property goes with it. For example, when King Stephen divided up the old earldom of Shiring, he gave the hill farms to Kingsbridge Priory, as we know only too well, but he did that in order to help finance the new cathedral. If we told him that someone else was building the new cathedral, he would expect the priory to release those lands to the new builders. The monks would put up a fight, of course, but examination of their charters would settle the matter. The picture was becoming clearer to William. Not only would Walleran get control of the cathedral by this stratagem, he would also get his hands on most of the priory's wealth. Father was thinking the same thing. It's a grand scheme for you, Bishop, but what's in it for me? It was Mother who answered him. Can't you see? She said tetchily. You own Shiring. Think how much prosperity would come to the town along with the cathedral. There would be hundreds of craftsmen and labourers building the church for years. They all have to live somewhere and pay you rent and buy food and clothing at your market. Then there will be the canons who run the cathedral and the worshippers who will come to Shiring instead of Kingsbridge at Easter and Whitsun for the big services, and the pilgrims who come to visit the shrines. They all spend money. Her eyes were bright with greed. William could not remember seeing her so enthusiastic for a long time. If we handle this right, we could turn Shiring into one of the most important cities in the kingdom. And it will be mine, William thought. When Father dies, I will be the Earl. All right, said Father. It will ruin Philip. It will bring power to you, Bishop, and it will make me rich. How could it be done? The decision to move the location of the cathedral must be made by the Archbishop of Canterbury, theoretically. Mother looked at him sharply. Why theoretically? Because there is no Archbishop just now. William of Corbeil died at Christmas, and King Stephen has not yet nominated his successor. However, we know who is likely to get the job. Our old friend Henry of Winchester. He wants the job, the Pope has already given him interim control, and his brother is the king. How much of a friend is he? Said Father. He didn't do much for you when you were trying to get this earldom. Walleran shrugged. He'll help me if he can. We'll have to make a convincing case. Mother said, he won't want to make powerful enemies just now, if he's hoping to be made Archbishop. Correct. But Philip isn't powerful enough to matter. He's not likely to be consulted about the choice of Archbishop. So why shouldn't Henry just give us what we want? William asked. Because he's not the Archbishop, not yet, and he knows that people are watching him to see how he behaves during his caretakership. He wants to be seen making judicious decisions, not just handing out favours to his friends. Plenty of time for that after the election. Mother said reflectively, So the best that can be said is that he will listen sympathetically to our case. What is our case? That Philip can't build a cathedral, and we can. And how shall we persuade him of that? Have you been to Kingsbridge lately? No. I was there at Easter. Walleran smiled. They haven't started building yet. All they've got is a flat piece of ground with a few stakes banged into the soil and some ropes marking where they hope to build. They've started digging foundations, but they've only gone down a few feet. There's a mason working there with his apprentice and the priory carpenter and occasionally a monk or two doing some labouring. It's a very unimpressive sight, especially in the rain. I'd like Bishop Henry to see it. Mother nodded sagely. William could see that the plan was good, even though he hated the thought of collaborating with the loathsome Walleran Bigod. Walleran went on, We'll brief Henry beforehand on what a small and insignificant place Kingsbridge is, and how poor the monastery is. Then we'll show him the site where it has taken them more than a year to dig a few shallow holes. Then we'll take him to Shiring and impress him with how fast we could build a cathedral there, with the bishop and the earl and the townspeople all putting their maximum energies into the project. Will Henry come?
Mother said anxiously. All we can do is ask. Walleran replied, I'll invite him to visit on Whitsunday, in his archiepiscopal role. That will flatter him by implying that we already consider him to be the archbishop. Father said, we must keep this secret from Prior Philip.
I don't think that will be possible, Walleran said. The bishop can't make a surprise visit to Kingsbridge. It would look very odd.
But if Philip knows in advance that Bishop Henry is coming, he might make a big effort to advance the building program.
What with?
He hasn't any money, especially now that he's hired all your quarrymen. Quarrymen can't build walls. Walleran shook his head from side to side with a satisfied smile. In fact, there isn't a thing he can do except hope the sun shines on Whitsunday. At first, Philip was pleased that the Bishop of Winchester was to come to Kingsbridge. It would mean an open-air service, of course, but that was all right. They would hold it where the old cathedral used to be. In case of rain, the priory carpenter would build a temporary shelter over the altar and the area immediately around it, to keep the bishop dry, and the congregation could just get wet. The visit seemed like an act of faith on Bishop Henry's part, as if he were saying that he still considered Kingsbridge to be a cathedral, and the lack of a real church was just a temporary problem. However, it occurred to him to wonder what Henry's motive was. The usual reason for a bishop to visit a monastery was to get free food, drink, and lodging for himself and his entourage. But Kingsbridge was famous, not to say notorious, for the plainness of its food and the austerity of its accommodation, and Philip's reforms had merely raised its standard from dreadful to barely adequate. Henry was also the richest clergyman in the kingdom, so he certainly was not coming to Kingsbridge for its food and drink. But he had struck Philip as a man who did nothing without a reason. The more Philip thought about it, the more he suspected that Bishop Walleran had something to do with it. He had expected Walleran to arrive at Kingsbridge within a day or two of the letter, to discuss arrangements for the service and hospitality for Henry, and to make sure Henry would be pleased and impressed with Kingsbridge. And as the days went by and Walleran did not show up, Philip's misgivings deepened. However, even in his most mistrustful moments, he had not dreamed of the treachery that was revealed, 10 days before Whitsun, by a letter from the Prior of Canterbury Cathedral. Like Kingsbridge, Canterbury was a cathedral run by Benedictine monks, and monks always helped one another if they could. The Prior of Canterbury, who naturally worked closely with the acting archbishop, had learned that Walleran had invited Henry to Kingsbridge for the express purpose of persuading him to move the diocese and the new cathedral to Shiring. Philip was shocked. His heart beat faster and the hand holding the letter trembled. It was a fiendishly clever move by Walleran, and Philip had not anticipated it, had not imagined anything like it. It was his own lack of foresight that shook him. He knew how treacherous Walleran was. The bishop had tried to double-cross him a year ago over the Shiring earldom, and he would never forget how angry Walleran had been when Philip had outwitted him. He could picture Walleran's face, suffused with rage, as he said, "I swear by all that's holy you'll never build your church." But as time went by, the menace of that oath had faded, and Philip's guard had slipped. Now here was a brutal reminder that Walleran had a long memory. Bishop Walleran says you have no money, and in 15 months you have built nothing, the Prior of Canterbury wrote. He says that Bishop Henry will see for himself that the cathedral will never get built if it is left to Kingsbridge Priory to build it. He argues that the time to make the move is now, before any real progress is made. Walleran was too cunning to get caught in an outright lie, so he was purveying a gross exaggeration. Philip had, in fact, achieved a great deal. He had cleared the ruins, approved the plans, laid out the new east end, made a start on the foundations, and begun felling trees and quarrying stone. But he did not have much to show a visitor. And he had overcome terrific obstacles to achieve this much, reforming the priory's finances, winning a major grant of lands from the king, and defeating Earl Percy over the quarry. It was not fair. With the letter from Canterbury in his hand, he went to his window and looked out over the building site.
Spring rains had turned it into a sea of mud. Two young monks, with their hoods pulled over their heads, were carrying timber up from the riverside. Tom Builder had made a contraption with a rope and a pulley for lifting barrels of earth out of the foundation hole, and he was operating the winding wheel while his son Alfred, down in the hole, filled the barrels with wet mud. They looked as though they could work at that pace forever, and never make any difference. Anyone but a professional would see this scene and conclude that no cathedral would be built here this side of the Day of Judgment. Philip left the window and returned to his writing desk. What could be done? For a moment he was tempted to do nothing. Let Bishop Henry come and look and make his own decision, he thought. If the cathedral is to be built at Shiring, so be it. Let Bishop Walleran take control of it and use it for his own ends. Let it bring prosperity to the town of Shiring and the evil Hamley dynasty. God's will be done. He knew that would not do, of course. Having faith in God did not mean sitting back and doing nothing. It meant believing that you would find success if you did your best honestly and energetically. Philip's holy duty was to do all he could to prevent the cathedral from falling into the hands of cynical and immoral people who would exploit it for their own aggrandizement. That meant showing Bishop Henry that his building program was well underway, and Kingsbridge had the energy and determination to finish it. Was it true? The fact was that Philip was going to find it mortally difficult to build a cathedral here. Already he had almost been forced to abandon the project just because the Earl refused him access to the quarry. But he knew he would succeed in the end because God would help him. However, his own conviction would not be enough to persuade Bishop Henry. He decided he would do his best to make the site look more impressive for what it was worth. He would set all the monks to work for the 10 days remaining before Whitsun. Perhaps they could get part of the foundation hole dug to its full depth, so that Tom and Alfred could begin laying the foundation stones. Perhaps a part of the foundation could be completed up to ground level, so that Tom could start building a wall. That would be a little better than the present scene, but not much. What Philip really needed was 100 laborers, but he did not have the money even for 10. Bishop Henry would arrive on a Sunday, of course, so nobody would be working, unless Philip were to co-opt the congregation. That would provide 100 laborers. He imagined himself standing up in front of them and announcing a new kind of Whitsun service. Instead of singing hymns and saying prayers, we're going to dig holes and carry stones. They would be astonished. They would... What would they do, actually? They would probably cooperate wholeheartedly. He frowned. Either I'm crazy, he thought, or this idea could actually work. He thought about it some more. I get up at the end of the service, and I say that today's penance for forgiveness of all sins is half a day's labor on the cathedral building site. Bread and ale will be provided at dinner time. They would do it. Of course they would. He felt the need to try the idea out on someone else. He considered Milius, but rejected him. Milius's thought processes were too similar to his own. He needed someone with a slightly different outlook. He decided to talk to Cuthbert Whitehead, the cellarer. He pulled on his cloak, drew the hood forward to keep the rain off his face, and went out. He hurried across the muddy building site, passing Tom with a perfunctory wave, and made for the kitchen courtyard. This range of buildings now included a henhouse, a cowshed, and a dairy, for Philip did not like to spend scarce cash on simple commodities that the monks could provide for themselves, such as eggs and butter. He entered the cellarer's storeroom in the undercroft below the kitchen. He inhaled the dry, fragrant air, full of the herbs and spices Cuthbert had stored. Cuthbert was counting garlic, peering at the strings of bulbs and muttering numbers in an undertone. Philip saw with a small shock that Cuthbert was getting old. His flesh seemed to be wasting away beneath his skin. 37, Cuthbert said aloud. Would you like a cup of wine?
No, thank you.
Philip found that wine in the daytime made him lazy and short-tempered. No doubt that was why St. Benedict counseled monks to drink in moderation.
I want your advice, not your victuals. Come and sit down.
Negotiating a path through the boxes and barrels, Cuthbert stumbled over a sack and almost fell before sitting on a three-legged stool in front of Philip. The storeroom was not as tidy as it had once been, Philip noted. He was struck by a thought. "Are you having trouble with your eyesight, Cuthbert?" "It's not what it was, but it will do," Cuthbert said shortly. His eyes had probably been poor for years. That might even be why he had never learned to read very well. However, he was obviously touchy about it, so Philip said no more, but made a mental note to begin grooming a replacement cellarer. "I've had a very disturbing letter from the Prior of Canterbury," he said, and he told Cuthbert about Bishop Walleran's scheming. He concluded by saying, "The only way to make the site look like a hive of activity is to get the congregation to work on it. Can you think of any reason why I shouldn't do that?" Cuthbert did not even think about it. "On the contrary, it's a good idea," he said immediately. "It's a little unorthodox, isn't it?" Philip said. "It's been done before." "Really?" Philip was surprised and pleased. "Where?" "I've heard of it in several places." Philip was excited. "Does it work?" "Sometimes. It probably depends on the weather." "How is it managed? Does the priest make an announcement at the end of the service, or what?" "It's more organized than that. The bishop or prior sends out messengers to the parish churches, announcing that forgiveness for sins may be had in return for work on the building site." "That's a grand idea," Philip said enthusiastically. "We might get a bigger congregation than usual, attracted by the novelty." "Or a smaller one," Cuthbert said. "Some people would rather give money to the priest, or light a candle to a saint, than spend all day wading in mud and carrying heavy stones." "I never thought of that," Philip said, suddenly deflated. "Perhaps this isn't such a good idea after all. What other ideas have you got?" "Not one." "Then you'll have to try this, and hope for the best, won't you?" "Yes," said Philip. "Hope for the best."
3. Philip did not sleep at all during the night before Whitsunday. There had been a week of sunshine, perfect for his plan. More people would volunteer in fine weather. But as darkness fell on the Saturday, it began to rain. He lay awake, listening disconsolately to the raindrops on the roof and the wind in the trees. He felt he had prayed enough. God must be fully aware of the circumstances now. On the previous Sunday, every monk in the priory had visited one or more churches to speak to the congregations and tell them they could obtain forgiveness for their sins by working on the cathedral building site on Sundays. On Whitsunday, they would get forgiveness for the past year, and thereafter a day of labour was worth a week of routine sins, excluding murder and sacrilege. Philip himself had gone to the town of Shiring and had spoken at each of its 4 parish churches. He had sent 2 monks to Winchester to visit as many as possible of the multitude of small churches in that city. Winchester was 2 days' journey away, but Whitsun was a 6-day holiday, and people would make such a trip for a big fair or a spectacular service. In total, many thousands of people had heard the message. There was no knowing how many might respond. For the rest of the time, they had all been working on the site. The good weather and the long days of early summer had helped, and they had achieved most of what Philip had hoped for. The foundation had been laid for the wall at the easternmost end of the chancel. Some of the foundation for the north wall had been dug to its full depth, ready for foundation stones to be laid. And Tom had built enough lifting mechanisms to keep scores of people busy digging the rest of the vast hole, if scores of people should turn up. In addition, the riverbank was crowded with timber sent downstream by the foresters and with stones from the quarry, all of which had to be carried up the slope to the cathedral site. There was work here for hundreds. But would anyone come? At midnight, Philip got up and walked through the rain to the crypt for matins. When he returned after the service, the rain had stopped. He did not go back to bed, but sat up reading. Nowadays, this period between midnight and dawn was the only time he had for study and meditation, for the whole of the day was always taken up with the administration of the monastery. Tonight, however, he had trouble concentrating, and his mind kept returning to the prospect of the day ahead and the chances of success or failure. Tomorrow he could lose everything he had worked for over the past year and more.
It occurred to him, perhaps because he was feeling fatalistic, that he ought not to want success for its own sake. Was it his pride that was at stake here? Pride was the sin he was most vulnerable to. Then he thought of all the people who depended on him for support, protection, and employment. The monks, the priory servants, the quarrymen, Tom and Alfred, the villagers of Kingsbridge and the worshippers of the whole county. Bishop Walleran would not take care for them, the way Philip did. Walleran seemed to think he was entitled to use people any way he chose in the service of God. Philip believed that caring for people was the service of God. That was what salvation was about. No, it could not be God's will that Bishop Walleran should win this contest. Perhaps my pride is at stake a little bit, Philip admitted to himself, but there are men's souls in the balance, too. At last dawn cracked the night, and once again he walked to the crypt, this time for the service of Prime. The monks were restless and excited. They knew that today was crucial to their future. The sacrist hurried through the service, and for once Philip forgave him. When they left the crypt and headed toward the refectory for breakfast, it was fully light, and there was a clear blue sky. God had sent the weather they had prayed for, at least. It was a good start. Tom Builder knew that his future was at stake today. Philip had shown him the letter from the Prior of Canterbury. Tom was sure that if the cathedral was built at Shiring, Walleran would hire his own master builder. He would not want to use a design Philip had approved, nor would he risk employing someone who might be loyal to Philip. For Tom, it was Kingsbridge or nothing. This was the only opportunity he would ever get to build a cathedral, and it was in jeopardy today. He was invited to attend chapter with the monks in the morning. This happened occasionally. Usually it was because they were going to discuss the building program and might need his expert opinion on questions of design, cost, or timetabling. Today he was going to make arrangements for employing the volunteer workers, if any came. He wanted the site to be a hive of busy, efficient activity when Bishop Henry arrived. He sat patiently through the readings and the prayers, not understanding the Latin words, thinking about his plans for the day. Then Philip switched to English and called on him to outline the organization of the work. "I shall be building the east wall of the cathedral, and Alfred will be laying stone in the foundations," Tom began. "The aim in both cases is to show Bishop Henry how far advanced the building is." "How many men will the two of you need to help you?" Philip asked. "Alfred will need two laborers to bring the stones to him. He'll be using material from the ruins of the old church. He'll also need someone to make mortar. I'll also need a mortar maker and two laborers. Alfred can use misshapen stones in the foundations, as long as they're flat top and bottom, but my stones will have to be properly dressed, since they will be visible above ground. So I've brought two stone cutters back from the quarry to help me." Philip said, "All that is very important for impressing Bishop Henry, but most of the volunteers will be digging the foundations." "That's right. The foundations are marked out for the whole of the chancel of the cathedral, and most of them are still only a few feet deep. Monks must man the winding gear. I've instructed several of you how to do it, and the volunteers can fill the barrels." Remigius said, "What if we get more volunteers than we can use?" "We can employ just about any number," Tom said. "If we haven't enough lifting devices, people can carry earth out of the holes in buckets and baskets. The carpenter will have to stand by to make extra ladders. We've got the timber." "But there's a limit to the number of people who can get down in that foundation hole," Remigius persisted. Tom had the feeling that Remigius was just argumentative. "It will take several hundred," he said testily. "It's a big hole." Philip said, "And there's other work to be done besides digging?" "Indeed," Tom said. "The other main area of work is carrying timber and stone up to the site from the riverside. You monks must make sure the materials are stacked in the right places on the site. The stones should go beside the foundation holes, but on the outside of the church, where they won't get in the way. The carpenter will tell you where to put the timber." Philip said, "Will all the volunteers be unskilled?" "Not necessarily. If we get people from the towns, there may be some craftsmen among them. I hope so. We must find out who they are and use them. Carpenters can build lodges for winter work.
Any masons can cut stones and lay foundations. If there's a blacksmith, we'll put him to work in the village forge making tools. All that sort of thing will be tremendously useful. Milius the bursar said, "That's all quite clear. I'd like to get started. Some of the villagers are here already, waiting to be told what to do."